calling. We're operating again over six stations, two in the 25, and the others in the 28, 31, 41, and 49 meter band. We now present Lord Haw-Haw speaking to England.
To say that the British Empire is in danger today would be a very feeble understatement. Never before has it been in such a perilous position. Until Roosevelt and Churchill so needlessly provoked Japan into taking up arms, the greater part of the British Empire felt itself outside the war zone. Of course, to be outside the war zone is not necessarily to be safe. For example, Canada was secure against any attack by Germany or Italy. But she was not secure against peaceful penetration by the United States. The agreement just concluded, whereby the virtual control of her industries falls into American hands, and whereby tariffs, customs, and other functions of independence may be arbitrarily removed by a committee under American domination, this charter of Canadian subjugation was not a mushroom growth. It was rather the culmination, at a suitable moment, of the plans which Roosevelt and his predecessors have been making for years to exclude British influence from both American continents. And, as a member of the Rockefeller family recently said in public, to give the United States a monopoly in the Western Hemisphere. Mr. Kitchener, the Australian Prime Minister, has addressed directly to President Roosevelt what amounts to an appeal for aid without safeguards. How far this message was inspired by Churchill himself, I cannot say. But Roosevelt now has an excuse for landing troops in Australia and keeping them there if he can until that inconceivable day when all Britain's debts to the United States shall have been paid. A member of the New Zealand cabinet declares that the most perilous moment in the history of his country has arrived. What the peoples of Australia and New Zealand may be thinking is easy to imagine. Their troops are fighting in North Africa to gain for Churchill prestige and propaganda victories, which, as previous events have shown, can exert no influence upon the issue of the war as a whole. They are at war with Japan, who has shown a most remarkable talent for carrying out multiple attacks on the widest scale. And on the other hand, they know that if American troops appear in the guise of saviors, they will remain in the role of bailiffs. They cannot be reassured by statements from the BBC to the effect that the home government sympathizes with their position, understands their concern, and will not forget them. But that on the other hand, they cannot expect the British forces to be everywhere at the same time. While such useless phrases might be accepted by the patient, docile, and uncritical British public, they are not sufficient to assuage the colonial unrest. Now, it is all the more remarkable that the United States should be gaining such an ascendancy over the British Empire when Roosevelt's conduct of the war against Japan has been such a signal failure up to the present. Having lost his Pacific fleet, he can hardly afford to pose as the master of the situation. And yet, Mr. Churchill will, in my opinion, bow to his wishes even more obsequiously than in the past. Without wishing in the smallest degree to underestimate the function of air power in the East Asian and Pacific War, a function which the Japanese have demonstrated with splendid success, I cannot help but pivoting Britain's present horrible dilemma to her naval weakness, at least in large part. A theater of war, including the Pacific Ocean, must needs raise great naval problems. If any British Prime Minister today were able to compensate for American naval losses by sending a large fleet to the Pacific, he could, if he had the will, tell Roosevelt to keep his hands off the Empire. The Royal Navy has no ships to spare, and the fate of the Prince of Wales and the Repulse is a token that a few warships would not be enough. Many are needed. The absolute size of a navy is of secondary importance in comparison with the range of tasks which it has to perform. For example, Switzerland does not need any battle cruisers. No navy can be, or at any rate can within years, be large enough to do battle against powerful opponents in all the waters of the world at the same time. The rulers of states interested in naval warfare must therefore either restrict their commitments or take the consequences. Germany, for example, did not require a large navy. Britain did. And in this respect, the British preparations for war were very inadequate. For many decades, Britain maintained her position in Eastern Asia on the strength of prestige and her navy, the two factors being very closely related. Leaving aside all questions of morality, let us say that if successive British governments, their chance of success was dependent, in large measure, on naval supremacy. Had Britain abstained from European entanglements, had her rulers renounced the claim to meddle in European affairs, then the power of the British crown in Eastern Asia might well have endured longer. It might have been possible to indulge the luxury of interfering with the peoples of Asia by refraining from the attempt to dominate Europe as well, although in the East the prestige of Britain has been declining for many years now. But the task of dominating both Europe and Asia is infinitely too great for Britain and the United States combined. When the demands on the Royal Navy were such that every single warship had to do the work of at least half a dozen, surely it would have been a prudent policy to leave Japan alone and at least to abstain from provocation of the type that Roosevelt and Churchill seemed to think so valorous. In November alone, the German forces sank the following British naval units: one aircraft carrier, one cruiser, three destroyers, and a number of smaller vessels. They damaged two battleships, including the Prince of Wales, the Repulse, and the seaplane carrier Unicorn of 14,500 tons. There's only a part of the price paid for the attempt to wage naval warfare on the Churchillian scale. Losses at this rate render far more difficult the task of the British commanders in solving every problem the war presents. Naval power for Britain is not an independent function. It is an indispensable aspect of her war potential as a whole. The United States are compact. The defense of their territory in the North American continent is no difficult matter. But the British Empire is scattered all over the world and is incomparably more assailable than the USA. What Roosevelt may lose in the Pacific is small in comparison with what Britain stands to lose. Even India is threatened. Canada is practically an American dominion ruled by Roosevelt. The fate of Australia and New Zealand hangs in the balance. The Royal Air Force is too weak. The Royal Navy is too weak. And as yet, the common sense of the British people is too weak to perceive the catastrophic nature of the plight into which they have allowed Churchill to lead them.
Germany calling.
Hello, North America.
You have just been listening to Law. And this talk by
Law will be repeated
at 10:45 p.m. Eastern Standard Time tonight. We should like now to repeat an announcement for 9 o'clock. At 9 o'clock, in 18 minutes from now, you will be listening to an interview with Jane Harrison and two Latvian women who journeyed during the Christmas season to Berlin to request Jane Anderson to deliver a message to the American people concerning the ravages of the Red Terror during the occupation of Latvia by communist forces. At 9 o'clock, Jane Anderson interviewed.